This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Hey, welcome to Business Made Personal. Today we have with us Graham Young. Now, Graham's a little different to the guests we normally get. Graham's job is in search, which we'll explain a little bit as we go through. Graham commenced his career on a claims box for a syndicate at Lloyd's of London and then spent over 30 years working in different guises in a claims capacity with general insurers, reinsurers, captive insurance vehicles, loss adjusters, TPAs, and brokers. Moving to the US in 2019, he used the next 3 years that he spent working in New York to gain a solid understanding of the executive search space. Today, Graham advises local and global insurance and reinsurance businesses in sourcing best-in-class talent. He is a director of the Elliott Partnership. Really pleased to have you on our program, Graham.
Thanks, Mark. My pleasure.
You ain't from around these parts, mate. Where did you grow up?
No, I'm not, although I like to think I am. My formative years up until secondary school, I was brought up on a border town between England and Wales, Dumfries. We moved around quite a bit. My father was in the bank, Royal Bank of Scotland at that time. And so we felt a little bit like gypsies, to be perfectly honest. There was a few towns in between, and then we finally landed in a town called Hamilton, which is in the heartland of Scotland, a coal mining and steel town, a pretty miserable town. But we landed there, and that's where I did my secondary education.
So your father was still in the bank at that stage, was he, Graham?
We moved. I was finishing secondary school, and that's when he decided to leave the bank and take up a position as CFO in the family business down in England. So that's what took us from Scotland to England. I was old enough at that time to certainly influence that decision. I was very keen to get out of Scotland. And as most people would know, I think Scots have that propensity to travel. So we're definitely known as gypsies, and we do like to travel. And that's probably what has shaped my desire to live in as many countries as I have done so far. So I was keen to get out of Scotland and keen to see what life in England was like. And we settled in Cambridge, just outside of London.
Talk me through those younger years, because if your father was in the bank and you were moving around a bit, did you find it difficult to find friendships or friendship groups?
Towns were a lot, I mean, like anywhere in the world, some towns were a lot more friendly than others. And I think at certain times in your life, it's easier to make friends. So I think I look back very, very fondly on my childhood in Dumfries. We were given the freedom, almost empowered at such a young age, to make our own decisions and make our own mistakes. The world was a different place then. It was a lot safer. So I remember in the school holidays, you know, we would say goodbye to our parents at 8 o'clock in the morning and say hi to them at 5 o'clock in the evening. And we're going off and explore and do things and have adventures. It's not that possible for kids to do that these days. The fond memories rest with me in terms of my childhood there. A little bit different. We hopped around a little bit after that, and it was a bit more challenging to make friends. And then, of course, life gets a bit more serious when you're at secondary school. So it's head down and bum up, and you've got to focus. So I don't think I've ever had a problem making friends. So I've got relatively fond memories of my entire life in Scotland, but doesn't detach from the fact I was desperate to get out of it.
So you spent that time in Hamilton, which is, as you said, a coal and mining town. That would have been significantly different to anything else you've done, I would have thought. How challenging was it?
It was challenging. I mean, it was more of you reflect on it now and you can compartmentalize your thinking now, but you don't necessarily think of what was happening and what was going through your head then. But I think it was a very grey town. I mean, everyone comments on the British weather. So you've got the weather impacting, and then you've got the pollution element as well that was associated with the era I lived in. So it was everything was grey. That's all I remember, really. That's the takeaway memories I have. Not great, not fantastic, But that probably, if there was ever a blue sky, I always remember looking up at the trails the aircraft made in the high altitudes, thinking, where's that going? I don't care where it's going, but it'd be nice to be on that one. So there was that, you know, I still think fondly of Scotland now. I still feel very patriotic, but it was tough as a kid growing up in that sort of environment. I mean, very different now. I mean, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Hamilton, they've gentrified, they've cleaned up. There are sources of culture, but back then it wasn't such.
No wonder you wanted to get out and get to England.
Exactly.
So you spent a lot of years in claims, and you're not the normal story we get where people go through and go into executive roles in insurance companies or in TPAs. You made a conscious decision to get into executive search?
Yeah, I did. And it's been a journey to get to where I am. But I reflected around about 2007, 2008 on what I had been doing in the years preceding, especially from the years 1999 when I moved to Australia. And the core or the common element that was part of my career was building teams or re-engineering teams, you know, finding talent, switching out talent for better talent, enhancing the talent of the group that I was part of. And so when I did leave Aon, which was like my last market-facing role, I took a bit of time off. I'd never taken any time off in my career. And I think it was important just to take some time off, you know, breathe, reset, and really understand, you know, where is that next chapter going to be? You know, I had looked at a number of opportunities that were very similar to that which I'd had before, going into other organizations, re-engineering, leading or building teams, but I wanted to change. And I looked back at what I had been doing, and that was that piece of attracting talent and building talent and building that best practice, best in class team. So that was the catalyst to me thinking, okay, I can stay in the insurance industry and the reinsurance industry, I can stay close to it, but I can do what I've been doing all along, but monetize it. So that was the catalyst to me moving into recruitment and kicking off my own business.
I'm trying to remember from what I read, you worked in Singapore for quite a number of years. You worked in the UK for a number of years, and you've recently come back to Australia.
Correct.
You would have a really, really good view on the talent in different countries. Without hoping you're going to say the right thing, but how do we compare globally?
It's an interesting question, that. And probably my answer is going to be shaped very much from my experience over the last few years in New York. You know, I had worked extensively in the US before, whilst I was in the market. Going back into that market again was quite interesting, because I was reinvigorating my networks and getting up to speed with a new, everywhere changes, America changed, New York had changed. I think the key difference is we operate in a very small market here, and I think it's insular in its nature, whereas you've got a much, much bigger market in the US, and you've got much greater competition for roles in the US as well. I mean, that could be argued these days, because there's massive competition right across the board for roles, because the talent is just not there. So the one thing I think I take away from my time in working in the US is the level of education that candidates have or appear to have. And I'm not just meaning that the degrees or the MBAs or the PhDs, I'm meaning the extensive on-the-job experience that they have and the research that they're willing to do when they're embarking on an interview process, for example, and looking at a new entity as a future employer. They do so much research. They come armed with that knowledge. So they're much more informed. But I think it's that approach that they take to every step of their career, throughout their career. So I find the level of knowledge and education within the candidates that I was talking to was far superior to probably anywhere in the world, and definitely Australia. But I go back to that caveat. I'm not knocking Australia, and I'm not knocking Australians. I think it's just And maybe it's driven by that American dream and that competition to be the best and, you know, surpass expectations. But I found that, you know, even the language that American candidates use is much more sophisticated, much more informed. So that would be the key difference between the two.
It's almost as though, you know, they live to work, whereas we more work to live.
Yes, and I wouldn't necessarily change that. So I'm not saying there's a good and a bad, or a right way or a wrong way, but yeah, they do, exactly.
So talk me through that. So you mentioned, you know, I mean, whilst we say we're part of the global world, we, because we're an island nation, we certainly have got a little bit of that insularity. Do you think that insularity is actually dampening individual growth aspirations within the country?
I mean, there's a potential for that. I think, is it dampening per se right across the board? No, it's not. I mean, there's some amazing Australian talent. And you know, if you look at some of the leaders across the world within the markets that we work in, there's some great Australian leaders there. I think it certainly has impacted. And one of the good things that Australians have under their belt is that willingness to travel and expose themselves to different cultures and different environments and things like that. So I think that probably counters that dampening effect. Everyone in our friendship group has probably traveled and lived in the UK or lived in the US or lived in Europe. So I think that probably is a counterbalance to that potential dampening effect. So you're still absorbing something from those experiences. You're absorbing, you know, that cultural difference, the different ways of doing things, the nuances of different areas and countries. So I think there's ways of, you know, lessening that dampening down. But I think if there was any advice I'd give to anyone in the industry is try and get out, try and find a role in another country and expose yourself to the different workings of that market, the different career aspirations of others around you in different countries, and then come back.
Because we've got a great lifestyle, right? You know, if you look at our work-life balance compared to most countries in the world, we leave it for dead. I worked for GE many, many moons ago, and the work culture in Japan, and a lot of people have probably experienced this. You know, you sleep under your desk, you go home when your boss goes home, all those sorts of things that is so antithesis to what we do in this country.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering whether you think that in Australia we are a little bit slower to embrace things like, you know, world's best practice, things like technological advancements to develop our careers. Have you seen what we do here as being different to what's happening globally?
I don't think there's a stark difference to what we do here to different pockets of the world. I think there's different areas, different industries that are maybe forging ahead faster in, say, that digitization space or life sciences space. So we all have, I don't think you could necessarily take a view that we're slower per se, we're slower across the board. You know, we're great and strong in certain areas. I certainly think that we could probably listen more and watch more and be exposed to and soak up the experiences of other more advanced, say, markets or bigger markets like the London market, like the US market, or look outside our traditional insurance and reinsurance markets to, I was only having this conversation yesterday, to the banking space. For example, if you're looking at that digitization and that embracing of tech solutions, there's no doubt about it that the banks lead that. And I think they lead that sector in every economy. Some economies are slightly more ahead of the curve than others. But I think we have to, you know, look outside the insurance market and reinsurance market to keep a pace with the advances in technology and other areas.
You know, you were in that claims space for many, many years, and then you've moved into executive search, which is still in that insurance space. What would you say that the insurance sector has given you that you personally never expected to get out of it, Graham?
Look, it's a career that I, like many of us who go into insurance, I would still say there's, you know, you ask 10 individuals how you got into insurance, and there's a common theme, we fell into it. When I look back at what I was doing before, a couple of years before I jumped into the insurance industry, you know, I was quite happy, you know, being a manager of a cocktail bar. But my parents didn't think so. And it wasn't a respectable career to follow. So I was told in no uncertain terms to find a proper job. And I had two choices. One was the insurance market, or one was the banking market. And before I could do anything about it, my CV had been printed off and distributed around Lloyd's of London. So that was the reason I got into the insurance industry, was by falling into it. I think the insurance industry, it touches on so many different industry sectors. I mean, pretty much whether you're in hospitality, whether you're in manufacturing, whether you're in chemicals, pharmaceuticals, it touches on every sector of commerce and industry. And as a consequence of that, you are being exposed, depending on where you're working within that space, it's claims or whether it's underwriting or whether it's, you know, any area, you're being exposed to those industries. So, and I was lucky enough to have this amazing education in the chemical and pharmaceutical space when I moved on to the captive side. And, you know, finding myself standing on chemical plants right next to the North Sea, freezing cold weather, trying to understand about superheated steam or how a cracker worked, you know, when you poured crude oil into it and what the byproducts were. It's that exposure, that saturation of so many different things that you're exposed to and you can learn from, and the industries that you can get yourself involved in. And that's the bit that you're exposed to, and not even your day-to-day job. And especially in claims, if I go back to claims, you know, it's often seen, and I think today it still is seen, as a slightly poor relation. You know, it's not the sexiest of jobs, and anyone that goes into claims generally is vying to get out of claims as soon as they possibly can do. But if you look at the claims environment, that's where you are exposed to even more of what goes on in the world. Yeah, I cut my teeth on asbestosis claims, U.S. asbestosis, Agent Orange, DDT. Claims and the impact that they had on kids and families and babies, and the health effects on individuals that had honestly put their life into their career mining or working in the manufacturing space involving asbestosis. So the learnings are just, I couldn't even list the learnings that I've gained from working in the insurance industry, not to mention the side benefits of being able to travel extensively in my roles. I mean, most of my roles were global roles. So, of course, if there was a typhoon, if there was an earthquake, if there was an explosion, I was on a plane to that location. So I was able to experience cultures and countries that I would probably never have thought of going to if it was left to me and a holiday choice. So many learnings from my career. I think it's the unsung element. Then when we're trying to promote insurance or reinsurance as a career, we miss that part. We miss the opportunities that someone could get in that market, which is way more than you can expect to maybe get in a banking space.
And just going back to your comment around, you know, dealing with asbestosis claims and Agent Orange claims, were you, you know, in front of some of the sufferers of those illnesses?
When I was exposed to those, I was on a syndicate that didn't lead most of the risks. So we were follow market. We weren't exposed directly to the claimants, but I have to say it was tough at times reading some of the claims files. And those claims files were also graphic as well. It was photographic evidence as well. So reading the claims files and the effects of chemicals on babies, that was tough. It was a baptism of fire, and it was a tough period to kind of get to grips with what was going on, but appreciate what was going on through a paper file. So it was an eye-opener, let me tell you. It was a big eye-opener for me. But, you know, sometimes you would close the file and go for a walk because you couldn't carry on reading it. The effect that, you know, had taken place on these kids or these babies.
Did that affect you mentally and emotionally?
I'm an individual that always has a capability to compartmentalize. And maybe that's why I don't remember dates very well, because there's certain periods in my life that I particularly don't want to remember. And that's not because there's bad things happening, but simply because, you know, it wasn't a great time or whatever. So I'm great at compartmentalizing. So I can close a file and go home at night and pick it up in the morning and not dwell on it too much.
It's part of your self-preservation mechanism, right?
It is.
I want to talk a little bit about the people you've come across over that sort of journey of yours, and not just in business, but just in your general life. Who has been the most influential person in your life?
I think I would say there were two people. throughout your life and your career and friendship networks, there's so many people that have an impact and have an influence on your life and add to who you are as a character now. But I would say, you know, looking back and reflecting on who I am now, there are two people. One was obviously my father. Well, maybe not so obvious, but my father. And then secondly, his brother, my uncle. And for two different reasons. My uncle was very driven and a very, very astute businessman. And that resonated with me at a very, very young age. And I used to shadow him and just absorb what I was hearing when he was negotiating or when he was conversing with his client base, etc. So I would spend most of my time in the family company offices during the summer holidays or any holiday for that matter. So he probably lit that fire and that passion for business, which has never left me. Yeah, I'm lucky enough to come from a family, a wider family. They're all business owners or were business owners. And so maybe it was instilled in my thinking early on that, you know, that was what I should be aspiring for, to own a business. But that's certainly what was the driver, I think, in that regard. My father, for a different reason. You know, we weren't particularly close. We became closer as he got older and probably as I became less truculent and actually listened to him. But if anything, you know, my father was a very, very honest guy and he had a very strong work ethic. And that effort that he put in, as every father does, was for one reason only, and that was for his family. So there was a real solid honesty to his being in every, he was with friends, whether it was with us. But I think he also shaped that moral compass that I now have and knowing right from wrong and when to do and when not to do. But look, I will say, there's many, many times I thought to myself, you know, he's wrong. I'll argue the point with him. But I can't remember a time where he was wrong. He was also an individual that was exceptionally well-read. He was just a font of knowledge. And he's been dead 5 years now, and I miss him. So, and sometimes I forget he's dead. Where I'm facing a problem, or whether it's with, you know, personal life or business life, he was always a great mentor in that regard. He would always be a great sounding board. So undoubtedly, you know, those two individuals shaped who I am today.
It's interesting, isn't it, the role parents play, that, and often it's an unsung role. I've been known to say to my boys when they were growing up, I'd say to them, I don't know how as you get older, I get dumber, but I don't like it. I want to ask you a little bit more, if we follow this line of logic a little bit. So, you know, over the course of your journey, you've been in quite a few countries. During that time, was there a significant turning point in your life, Graham?
I think two turning points, I would say. One would be, you know, I was given the opportunity to come to Australia to open up a claims management entity that became a very successful business. It wasn't that as being the turning point. It was probably that it just the final culmination of a lifelong ambition, which was to get to Australia. So that was definitely a turning point, and doors opened and gateways opened. And I think when you succeed in achieving something you've had as a target for some time, you become a far, far greater ambition, for example. I think that was a turning point. I certainly felt more ambitious and more empowered when I came to Australia. That was the turning point. And I think maybe in a few years after that, well, a good few years after that, probably the biggest turning point for me was maybe coming out of that corporate environment. You know, I said before, Aon was my last market-facing role. And, you know, I had worked for large, you know, Swiss or American entities. I mean, it was wonderful at the time when you leave the business, but just to leave that corporate life and not have the ball and chain of corporate life attached to you. But it's also scary because it's what next? So these would be the core turning points. I mean, I felt a lot of freedom when I eventually became comfortable leaving corporate life. And it took a period of adjustment. That's probably why I took a year off after I left Aon in 2007 to 2008. I took that time off just to reset and think and breathe and just not rush into something and try something different maybe and try something left field. But it was that, I think, that light bulb moment where you suddenly feel free. But that freedom also is scary, I would say.
And all of those things, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages and everything, isn't there? I mean, if you look at some of those corporate roles, more often than not, you've got to deal with the politics. But on the positive side, you've got, you know, endless resources that you can draw on. The learning and the experience and the education is second to none. Much more difficult to do that in a smaller organization, but you don't necessarily have the sort of challenges because you're a jack of all trades, right?
Yep.
If you could go back to that young man in Hamilton and give him a little bit of advice now that you know what you know, what would you say to him?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, I was chatting to my son the other day there, and he's 13, and he's got a very, very clear idea of what he wants to do. He's 13. He's not even started those tough years of exams to follow yet. But he knows he wants to be a lawyer. And he doesn't just know he wants to be a lawyer. You know, he wants to be a barrister as well. And then once he's achieved that, he wants to go back into the corporate life because that's where the dollars are. So that, and that's his story, not my story. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I think probably it's a story that many in my generation relate to. I don't think I would change a thing. I never have regrets. I might feel annoyed at myself for making some decisions. You make these decisions as you do mistakes, you make mistakes, and you learn from them. And I don't think I would have changed a thing. I think I made a conscious decision. And again, I think this goes back to my drive to be in business. But I made a conscious decision to finish secondary education and not go to university. And that has played on my mind. And maybe I do, if there was anything that I would tell that younger kid, is to maybe just rethink that. And not because I feel I would have necessarily benefited and be a better person now, because there's other ways you can fill that education gap. You know, there's many, many times I've thought to myself, am I a lesser person because I haven't got a degree, follow that track? But then I'm put into check pretty quickly by my peers and my friends who have said, well, look at where you've got to and look at what you've done without it. But I think it's that peer pressure. And for the generations now coming up through that education process, it's different. I mean, you can't compete in the job environment without a degree. But maybe I would have just nudged that kid and be myself a little bit to think a bit more carefully about that choice. I mean, look, I eventually went to college. I didn't do particularly well there. But I just didn't like that framework of education and sitting in. I just wanted to get out and be free and earn money. That was my major focus. So sitting in a classroom, listening to hypotheticals, you know, didn't do me any good whatsoever. I mean, I remember being pulled in after year one, being told, look, you're going to get chucked off the course if you don't knuckle down. So I did knuckle down and I came up with something, but not a lot.
No. And I wonder whether there's that sort of, you know, that sort of, because you never had that formal education younger, I just wonder if it spurred you on to prove that you're as good as, if not better.
Absolutely. I think it gives you that bigger drive. And if you don't know something, you're going to find out something. You're going to find out what that means or the impact of something. So my drive and my ambition has never wavered. Absolutely.
Hey, I want to read something to you, but before I do, people listening to this podcast, we are speaking with Graham Young, who's the director of Elliott Partnership, an executive search business. Graham, one of your clients, Amol Godha, I hope I'm saying his name right, Amol Godha, the strategy and data analytics head at Reliance Nippon Life Insurance, had this to say about you. Graham is the best consultant I've worked with in talent management. His biggest asset is taking end-to-end ownership of the task and going out of the way to ensure his assignments are done perfectly. Not just well, but perfectly, Graham. His passion for people and clients is unmatched. Very happy to have worked with him and highly recommend him. What do you think you do differently to most others out there?
I think it's listening and hearing. And you know, I often say to people, especially, you know, younger team members, you're listening and you're hearing. If you're talking, then you're not listening and hearing. And I think that didn't come naturally to me because, you know, as an ambitious and driven individual, you want to portray that you know. And how do you do that? You verbalize it. And so, you know, it's come over a few years and obviously with maturity. But I think it's the It's the listening, understanding, and the hearing. And I think it comes with, I'm going to say age. I shouldn't say age, but it comes with maturity. You've got a dearth of experience and knowledge behind you. And it's how you impart that knowledge and experience into conversations that you might be having with your clients or your candidates for that matter. And I think that's what we or I do differently. And I enjoy it. It's, you know, I was saying to somebody earlier today, my job now doesn't feel like work. It's talking to people and it's listening to people and it's hearing what they're thinking and being empathetic to that and drilling down and understanding. And it's through that understanding that you ultimately make a good match of candidate to employer, as opposed to listening to 10 seconds of what somebody wants. I'm exaggerating, saying 10 seconds. Let's give them a minute. We'll give them a minute to listen to what somebody wants. And making an assumption that that little red round peg is going to go into that square hole. And it's an old analogy and it's a cliche. But if you listen and you understand and you probe and understand more through that interrogation process or that discussion process, interrogation is too strong a word, you're going to understand what the motivators are. You're going to understand the motivators from both sides, the drivers, the needs, and the fits better. So I think that's what we do better in the business that I'm part of now.
Can I take you back to, you mentioned that has come with maturity. I just wonder, has it come with maturity or has it come with confidence? Has it come with the confidence that you don't need to necessarily prove yourself any longer? And as a result of that, it gives you that opportunity to listen. Do you think that has something to do with it?
Inextricably linked, though, isn't it? The maturity is, the experience increases as you mature. That's just what you should do, unless you bury yourself under a stone for a period of time. But I think it's linked. With that experience and with that knowledge, you build in confidence, and then you can be the way you are. So I think it's all interlinked.
What would you say has been the most challenging time in your career, Graham?
A couple, I would say. I regard my first career role as the position I took at the ICI captive insurance company. I remember seriously thinking that, A, I've got through the interview process and I was embarking on a proper job. My other jobs were great, but it wasn't a proper career move. But at the time, I was diagnosed with quite a debilitating arthritis. And it's very uncommon so it hits under 35-year-olds. And I don't know the stats, I can't remember the stats, but look, basically, I was pretty much bedridden for 3 months, but I'd managed to get out of bed and get walking and get to the point where I could get to the interview. So I managed to get through the interview process with a significant amount of pain and disability. And I remember getting the job offer and accepting it and thinking, how the hell am I going to get out of bed and get to work? It would take me at the time, it took about 2 hours to actually get my joints moving again to walk. And up until that point, you're crawling around the bedroom trying to pull things together and get your clothes sorted out and all the rest of it. So that would be probably the toughest part. Knowing that you're embarking on that first career move, and I was physically disabled as a consequence of this, it went into remission. And, I went back to being an outdoorsy person that I had been beforehand and playing sports and participating in, you know, all sorts of sports and running. So it was short-lived with the assistance of quite a lot of medication. But that was probably the hardest, toughest point in my career, because I wanted that job so much. And there was no way in the world that anything was going to stop me. But I certainly didn't expect to be in that position of incapacity physically. That was tough.
So when you were diagnosed, did you know it was only going to last for a few months, or is that the rest of your life mentally you had to prepare for?
Yeah, the prognosis wasn't good. The prognosis was it was going to get worse. So, and that was tough to absorb. The doctors all said, look, this is the prognosis, but we just don't understand enough about this disease to really project what could happen next. So the prognosis wasn't good, but it happened. It was the toughest point in my career, but in my life, you just move on, you get through it. I'm lucky enough to be in remission. Nothing's ever come back. It's never affected me in any way, shape or form since then. I think I had it overall for about 7 years, but it got milder. So it wasn't easy as a young guy being diagnosed with something that was just going to get worse.
So how old were you at this stage?
I think I was about 28.
Wow. And were you on your own at that point, or were you with your family, or?
I had a partner, but not a lot other people can do. I mean, you want to be independent, so you feel quite isolated. No matter how many people you've got round about you, and I did, of course, have my family round about me. This is when I was living in London. I had great friends, but it was you that was feeling that agonizing pain every step you made, and getting out in the morning and rolling out of bed because you couldn't stand to get out of bed, that sort of thing. You do feel quite isolated. You've just got to deal with it. And it's easy for me to say that now. Got to deal with it. But yeah, thankfully, the medication provided some relief. I think from memory, it was the medication that pushed it into remission.
And what was the mental journey you were going through at that age, 28? You wouldn't know up from down, I wouldn't have thought.
I'm the type of person that never actually reflects on the mental side of things. I don't know if I can answer that question. I'm always one to my brain will always say to me, no matter what the challenge is, whether it's getting on stage and public speaking as I've done in the past, or getting in front of a board of directors and presenting, or pitching, or negotiating, or getting out of bed with that debilitating illness, I only have one focus, and that is to get through it and get past it, and to do so in the best and optimum way. So I never think negatively. I've always been probably, I think of myself as a realist, but I'm probably an optimist. As I've matured, I'm probably becoming more of a realist now. Maybe it's just the knocks and the bumps and of life that have made me a realist.
Yeah, that's right. And I think certainly in my case, I'm a lot more of a realist these days because I'm older. Graham, I've got two final questions for you, sir. The first one is, given your knowledge and experience in executive search, we have a lot of people listening to this podcast who are looking to develop their careers, primarily in the insurance space. What advice would you have for those people that are interested in advancing their careers?
It depends what stage everyone's at, but I think if you're going to advance your career and you're going to move into or have a desire to maybe move into a different space, one of the great things about the insurance industry and reinsurance industry and everything in between it, there's a lot of great veterans in the industry. As a consequence of that, there's a lot of good people to talk to. I think sometimes traditionally we've been pushed into avenues that we think is the right way to go because our mates are there or someone we aspire to is there, but we haven't necessarily checked ourselves to say, is that right for me? And I think we can do, I spend a lot of time talking to not just younger candidates, candidates of all ages, and just double checking with them what the motivators are, what the drivers are, why are you wanting to go down that path as opposed to this path or depart from that role to go into this next role. I think the advice I would give is just talk to those around you. I mean, there's just so much intelligence in those that are in the industry. And one of the things that the industry I think is really good at is it does share information well, and it is an open industry. And if you do approach someone to have a coffee, to have a chat, to soundboard off that person, there's more likelihood you're going to get a yes than a no. That would be my advice. It's not necessarily a career in claims is not necessarily your foundation, but a career in claims could be the best career you could ever choose. So do you necessarily need to go into underwriting or wherever? So I think it's listening and understanding and talking to people and getting that information. But I think as things change, we're seeing roles that have been traditionally occupied maybe by underwriters are now being occupied by actuaries, for example. It's really important to understand that landscape more and see what else is there as a option in your career path, if that makes sense.
And the final question for you, sir, what's next for Graham Young?
If you'd asked me that 15 years ago, because I would be aspiring to this and this and that. And right now, I joke with people, it's taken me 30 years to find the job that I really enjoy. So for me, it's more of the same. I've been given this wonderful challenge that's coincided with me returning to Australia to build a business that is just as successful as we have in other parts of the world, London and New York and Singapore, Zurich. That's a challenge for me. So it's more of the same. It's more of the doing what we've done and carrying on doing it to the best of our ability and delivering that white glove service, which I love doing day in day.
Yep. And you're clearly good at it. Otherwise, you wouldn't last in that industry for as long as you have.
I'll let other people decide that.
Graham Young, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on Business Made Personal. Thank you for sharing some time with us.
Thank you. My pleasure. It's been great. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.